Hello, Logging Heads viewers, and welcome to yet another episode of Foreign Entanglements. I am Dr. Robert Farley of the Patterson School of Diplomacy and International Commerce at the University of Kentucky, and with me today is Michael Cohn, who is a fellow at the Century Foundation. Michael is currently in San Diego, California. I am in beautiful Lexington, Kentucky. How is the weather out there?
Oh, San Diego is fantastic. I was just here at the ISA conference, which was a rather interesting event and an important reminder of why I never tried to get a PhD in political science.
Well, that's a terrible thing. Sorry. Why would you say something like that?
I can't imagine what would cause me to say something like that. It's something about political science writ large, just about, I think, more me and my own particular areas of interest, I will say. And I will warn Blogging Heads viewers that I'm doing this Blogging Heads with two dogs around me who tend to bark. So if you hear some background noise or see my an old man walking behind me, that's my father-in-law. So just giving you a heads up on that.
Well, I would say it's unprecedented to have any sort of animal around you or in any significant way to interact during a Blogging Heads. And, frankly, given even the very limited standards of professionalism that we have here at Foreign Entanglements, I think those really breach those standards.
I hope you'll let me back after this episode. I really do.
Yeah. We'll talk about it. We'll have some internal discussions regarding that. Anyway, so we have a fair amount of things to talk about. I don't think we'll probably get to all of it because I think we both are under a little bit of time constraints. First things first, there has been a fair amount about that has developed in the last week with regards to evaluation of the situation in Libya. There were two really large things, one of which is sort of the continuing chaos within Libya, chaos might be the wrong word, the continuing lack of governmental authority, state authority within Libya, the second being the state of politics in Mali, where apparently there's been a coup and so forth.
Yes.
Now, if I recollect correctly, you were a qualified supporter. I don't even know how to characterize what I wrote on Libya. I mean, mostly I just concentrated on the operational details. I think that I was skeptical without sort of ever coming out and being anti. So I straddled. I guess I was a straddler. How would we go about assessing the situation in Libya now and what it means?
I straddled also. I mean, I was sort of on the fence on this. I was very skeptical because I'm usually always skeptical of military interventions.
Mm-hmm.
But I say on this one, I kind of come down as a supporter. But I think it depends on the frame.
Uh-huh.
So here's my suggestion for how we should maybe approach this. I think there's four frames how to think about this. I'm sure other viewers will think of 100 more frames. But to me, the one frame is from a narrow perspective of U.S. national security interests. The second one is, the impact at home on sort of executive power. I think the third one is obviously the effect on Libya and the region. And the last one is sort of a normative question about what does this say about R2P and these types of humanitarian interventions. So one of narrow U.S. interests, to me, I think this is sort of an easy one. Because to me, the costs, which were pretty minimal, are more to the U.S., and I mean that mainly in treasure and manpower, is more than outweighed by the benefits. And to me, the benefits, are and again, I look at this from the perspective of having to make a crisis decision. The Obama administration was faced with a very difficult decision, the possibility of Benghazi being overrun. I mean, I think we could probably agree that some of the rhetoric around that was overstated, but there was, in the administration, there was a sense and a legitimate fear that if we did nothing, allow this to happen, it would, it would look badly for the U.S. and the region. It would harm U.S. relations with key allies, both in NATO and, the Gulf states. And so I think from that perspective, as far as more of a defensive measure, the Libya operation is probably pretty defensive if you look at it, if you, again, judging it from the narrow perspective of national security interests.
Right. I mean, and I guess my response to that is that, first, that I don't necessarily disagree with any of those claims, but you are dragging in a tremendous amount of baggage and a tremendous number of sort of unspecified assumptions and values with regards to what U.S. national security is. Now, I mean, if you had just run that sentence past Dan Larison or Stephen Walt or anyone of a more realist disposition, they would have like 43 things to say that were wrong.
Their heads would explode.
Right. I mean, they would say, well, who care? I mean, yeah, oh, so our allies will be unhappy. Well, you know, that's too bad. Our allies are around to help us, right? Not us to help our allies and so forth. And, you know, what do we care about people in a faraway place who bad things may or may not happen to them, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. My first response would be there's nothing narrow about the national security framing that you just created, right? I think it's really an expansive national security framing.
I mean to judge the operation from the narrow perspective of U.S. interests as opposed to, you know, the impact on the region or the larger issues involved. I'm just looking at it from a very narrow issue of U.S. interest. But go ahead, sorry.
Right. I think it's difficult because at the same time, I think it's clear that the Gaddafi regime was becoming increasingly pliable with regards to a lot of other things that the United States wanted out of it, such as proliferation concerns, such as access to and state access, or U.S. and also more Western access to Libyan oil and so forth, such as terrorism. And you know, there were a variety of ways in which the Gaddafi regime was saying and doing things that would, under many different framings, be positive for U.S. national security. And so, you know, again, I mean, I think that probably my conception of U.S. national security is closer to yours than it is to Dan Larison's. Whether it was in U.S. national security is entirely contingent upon that framing, right? And I think it's really easy to sort of put together a framing which says this was not in our national interest at all. And say, you know, it was a minimal cost, so not a big deal, right? This was not Iraq, right? We're not stuck there for X number of years with X number of deaths. And so, you know, even if you have an extremely narrow understanding of U.S. national interest, you know, Libya is still not such a big deal on that line. But
No, I agree with that. It's not a big deal. And I think from an interest perspective, it's a very minor deal. And, you know, the benefits that we got, you know, you keep the European allies happy. And at that point, you know, that might make a difference in Afghanistan. So it's and we asked a lot for them in Afghanistan. So doing something for them, Libya, you know, there's a certain benefit to that, at least for the French and the British. I mean, obviously, there's different views inside NATO. You know, supporting the Gulf states were very behind this, and you know, you sort of it's you know real, somewhat important to keep the Gulf states happy at this point. Particularly, we're dealing with Iran. You know, so again, I agree with you. I mean, I think also there's a third part too, which is that I think the view of the administration, this may have been wrong, but I think there was a legitimate a view inside the administration that to not support this this effort, what appeared to be a pro-democracy effort. You know, would in a sense undercut the Arab Spring. I think there was that sense within the administration. Whether that's true or not, I'm not really sure. But I think that view probably was there. And I'm willing to give policymakers the benefit of the doubt as far as, you know, believing that. Well, it may be wrong in retrospect, and I'm not sure that it is. I think it was a legitimate thing to view at the time and say, okay, you know what? This is going to cost us not very much to get involved, and it looks like we're on the good side here. But I think your overall frame is right. From the larger perspective, this doesn't mean a lot for U.S. interests, but I also think the costs didn't mean a lot either from a U.S. interest perspective.
Right. Okay, so what was your second metric? Remind me.
I'm sorry?
Your second metric. What was the second metric?
Second
for
metric would be, well, I guess we can do two or three. We can do one or two metrics. So I guess the implications at home for executive power, which I've written a little bit about, or the impact on Libya and the region as a whole.
Right. Okay. Why don't we sidestep the implications at home, because I'm not sure how to characterize them. You know, my first cut would be that, you know, executive power over foreign policy and war was pretty unquestioned before this, and, you know, whereas Libya might have laid bare some assumptions, that it, you know, didn't really change how the executive thinks about its privilege in terms of going to war. But, I mean, if you want to talk about it, we can talk about that. But why don't we get to the interesting part right now, which is sort of the effect that Libya has had on the region, especially Mali and so forth.
Yeah, I mean, I think there it's a little harder to say this has been a success. But again, you're dealing with a counterfactual. What would have happened had Gaddafi stayed? Would there have been instability? What would have been the larger impact on the region? I don't know the answer to, and I think it's kind of too early to tell. You know, if 20 years from now Libya turns into or even less than that, hopefully, quasi-functional democracy, then do we look back and say this was a success? Even if the road to get there is pockmarked along the way, and I don't know the answer to that question. I think it's too soon to say.
Right. And we should note that Gaddafi himself was never someone to really let his neighbors alone, and that he fairly constantly intervened in, and of course, you know, somebody's going to say in comments, well, the United States intervenes in the politics of its neighbor, which is true, but so did Gaddafi. We can't really sort of rely on that Libya under Gaddafi was going to be sort of a relatively good citizen, even from an authoritarian point of view. Libya had taken active steps to destabilize its neighbors in the past, and such steps might have continued in the future, although it sort of dialed those down in some ways over the past decade or so. It's really hard to say. My immediate thinking is that a lot of this stuff that we sort of blame immediately on the Libya situation is stuff that, as you say, might well have happened anyway. We are, taking some real linkages and some real correlations and mistaking them for causation when we talk about the effect that Libya's had. I guess a slightly more interesting question then, and I think this gets to one of your metrics as well, is what effect did Libya have on Syria? Because this was one of the big things where people were talking about.
This is what everyone wants to talk about, right? That supposedly it stopped the UN from interacting in Syria. I think this is a facetious argument. I don't buy it at all. We would not have intervened in Syria, and certainly I think, even if we hadn't lied, and we did lie, about the extent to which we were going to try to get rid of Gaddafi, I don't think it would have changed much in the way of Russian or Chinese calculus when it came to Syria.
Yeah, no, I know. I think that argument is almost entirely nonsense. The idea that the Russians would not have noticed, I can't remember who characterized this, but you have to assume that the Russians are stupid with regards to, what really is a key Middle East interest. Libya was not a key Middle East interest, and Syria really is a key Middle East interest, and the Russians wouldn't be able to figure out some sort of UN Security Council resolution with regards to Syria would not have eventually allowed regime change. And the Russians just aren't that dumb, right? I mean, they distrust, and the Russians and the Chinese have a healthy degree of distrust for the United States and its allies. And there's no way they would have just let that slide by. I can understand, as you suggest, it's right that the Russians do feel that they were lied to with respect to
regime
Libya
change.
And the extent of what operations we're going to look like in Libya, and that's not unreasonable, but it's an initial leap from there to say that Libya really changed the Russian calculus with regards to Syria.
Right. I agree, and I think this is an argument that is used to sort of by opponents of the Libya operation to attack it, and I think in a sense it's not really a sustainable argument. Now, the other issue, and this is something that came up recently, is that a lot of policymakers now, U.S. policymakers, are saying this is some kind of a model for future interventions. And of course, that's a big argument that the pro-Syria intervention folks have been using. And here, I have to say, I think this is really dangerous and really wrong.
Right.
Libya is a very unique example of where you had regional as well as NATO support for the operation. You had U.N. support. Obviously, that's huge. You had a leader in Libya, Gaddafi, who is, to coin a phrase, a flake, and who no one really liked that much. You had territorially very easy to get involved, actually, much easier than in Syria, where you had this sort of strange territorial delineation that allowed the U.S. to engage militarily in a way that could be decisive. So I think, stars were very much aligned on Libya in a way that almost never happens, and it will never happen in any other intervention. So I think I'm very suspicious of drawing any parallels from this about future military interventions. Now, if you want to draw parallels about future, non-military interventions or non-military engagements in situations in which, leaders are killing their own people, that's a different story. But as far as military intervention, I don't think there's much here for future ones.
Right. And one additional that I would add on that is that, and especially in this is a difference between Libya and both Iran and Syria, is that Libya really lacked an organized professional military. I mean, it was a deeply politicized.
Yes.
Syria's military is also politicized, but there's a professional element to it, and it's well trained and it's well organized. And the Libyan military really lacked all that, and which is why. Neither side really made use of the Libyan military, right, of the Libyan army. Gaddafi employed large numbers of mercenaries and also sort of tribal loyalists, and even when there were defections...
Ukrainian bodyguards, let's not forget
right,
that.
Right, exactly. Even when there were major defections to the rebel side, that didn't seem to be in terms of any sort of professionalized or effective formation, military formations. And so what you had was sort of unprofessional formations fighting on the one side against unprofessional formations on the other side. Something
right.
like that is deeply unlikely to be repeated in Syria. You know, there are cases that are similar to that in the world, right? And you know, there are lots of states that, you know, don't organize their military along, you know, broadly professional lines. But you got to recognize that that's a difference when you're thinking about intervening somewhere, and Syria is not like that.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right. I completely agree. And so, I think that, and it concerns me that I hear policymakers making this argument. I think, you know, it doesn't hold up. I think is what it comes down to. And I think, you know, it doesn't mean that the global international community or the U.S. cannot try to stop. You know, dictators from killing their own people. It doesn't mean we can't impose sanctions. It doesn't mean we can't impose, you know, arms embargoes or things like that, or non-military means to stop these kind of abuses from happening. It just doesn't mean that we have to engage militarily every time this stuff occurs. I think that, I find, you know, incredibly frustrating when the immediate response to any of this is I saw something today, NATO should get involved in Mali. I mean, there's always a sense, you know, the military solution of these very rarely works, you know, and in fact, and of course in Libya, we don't know if it did work as far as Libya and the region's long-term future. And I think that, you know, we should be very careful about this and if we can argue that Libya might have been successful, and I think, you know, again, the jury's still kind of out on it a little bit. It's not transferable. I think that's the most important point. It's not
right.
transferable.
So let me drag this, because you and Mike Isenko just had an article in Foreign Affairs about.
I want to go back one second if I could, because you sort of glossed over the executive power issue, uh-huh. and I actually think that's the most important thing from Libya, and I'm just going to make my case for it, and then we can move on.
Okay.
But I think. The extent to which the president completely sidetracked Congress on authorization of force in Libya in a way that I don't think he had to be honest. I think he could have gotten support for it. I think it's very dangerous. And I think we know executive power is expanding, and this is, you know, it's like the universe is expanding. We know this is constantly happening. But to have Obama do this, who's somebody who basically really did run against this idea of having a executive, you know, branch being able to fight wars without congressional authorization, without congressional support, and to sort of do it so brazenly, and do it in a way that really, I think, hollowed out what's left of the War Powers Resolution, which is already sort of on its last leg, is pretty dangerous and pretty bad. I mean, I think, you know, future presidents, you know, a President Romney or whatever, will only further expand those powers. And it would have been good to see. The thing about it is that Obama could have very easily gotten authorization for this, and it would have reasserted the notion that Congress should have a say in when Americans go to fight wars. And that he didn't, I think, is incredibly destructive.
Right. I mean, I wonder if the Obama administration sort of had learned a lesson by that time that any issue that it took a position on was going to run afoul of a very significant Republican opposition, right? And so even to the extent that it seemed like, well, yeah, you know, you probably could have gotten resolutions passed now as House of Representatives and the Senate. But maybe not. And it would have been embarrassing not if you tried it and not gotten it. And it especially would be problematic if you assign congressional, or if you suggest the congressional role here, and then, you know, Obama wins and the Democrats have neither the House nor the Senate, and essentially that ties Obama's hands for the next 4 years. And so that, I mean, I don't know if that was the thinking. That may have been the thinking.
I'm sure that was the thinking. I'm sure that was it. I'm sure they said Congress is partisan. Congress is not is going to find somebody to screw us on this, and we're not going to we're not going to take that risk. But you know, that's not real. Look, Congress being partisan and parochial and crazy is not an excuse to ignore their legitimate role.
Part of the definition of Congress.
Exactly right. But that doesn't give you an out. You know, I mean, we wouldn't. None of us would have said that about. If Bush had said in 2002, I'm not going to get congressional office because Congress is too partisan, too parochial, whatever, none of us on the left would have said, that's okay, we get it. No, we would have said, this is ridiculous. Congress has a role to play. And Bush, for all of his faults, at least did get congressional authorization. I mean, he did it in a way that's very political, but he got authorization to go to war in Libya. I mean, in Iraq.
I mean, I guess the reason that I don't, you know, there were some aspects of it, and I think I wrote a column about this, I can't remember, but there were some aspects of it that... You know, we're certainly distasteful and problematic from an American political point of view. But I'm just not convinced that precedent matters that much. Here, I mean, and that's because, as people amply pointed out in a lot of different places, well, you know, the Lawfare blog, but a lot of other places, presidents have long perceived themselves to have very expansive powers with regards to war and peace, and have long believed themselves to be effectively immune to congressional oversight. And so, you know, the simple fact that a president like Obama would have, in some other world, felt the need to go and get congressional authorization, you know, isn't really going... Let me put it this way. The fact that Obama... thinks that he could get by without congressional authorization really isn't that much different than the fact that it isn't that much different of a precedent than the fact that Bush thought he did need congressional authorization, right? If you know, Bush couldn't set a precedent for, and maybe he didn't want to set a precedent, but if the fact that Bush went and got congressional approval for the Iraq War didn't set a precedent that Congress was going to be important in these kind of cases, then I'm not sure what would, right? Someone who is sort of congenitally dismissive of congressional power nevertheless went to Congress. But nobody really thought that that was a very important precedent in this case, and so I guess I'm not convinced that,
that
Obama's
behavior
really changes it.
It doesn't. I mean, look, in a way, you're right. I mean, the next Republican president will not feel constrained by what Obama did or didn't do in Libya. If they want to blow up, you know, they want to expand the executive power to make war, they'll do it. I just think that Obama could have gone a different direction and said, you know, even if dealing with Republican Congress, it's important for Congress to have a say in these types of operations. And I think what he's doing instead is saying, Congress, he's basically daring Congress to cut off funding for that. That's the only way they can stop him from going to war. And I think, or in this case, going to war in Libya. And I realize that they define, you know, hostilities in a way they claimed it didn't require congressional authorization. But I think you and I would agree that definition was pretty ridiculous.
Oh yeah, no, it was pretty absurd. It was absurd.
Yeah. So I just think I mean, your point is correct. But again, just because Republicans, you know, might in the future not abide by this precedent, or, you know, doesn't mean that it isn't important to set it. And of course, the other part of it is that Congress has a role to play here too. And Congress once again showed itself to be feckless and weak and unwilling to step up to the plate and actually hold the executive branch, you know, accountable for their actions. And, you know, there is much to blame here as Obama. And it reminds me of, my mom actually read that piece, and she emailed me, and she said, why does Obama do this? You know, and I said, because he can. You know, and that's why he does it, and no one will stop him. And if no one will stop him, no one will stop them. Presidents will expand their power. So, you know, there's a responsibility in Congress here as well. There's no question about it.
Right. Okay. So let's. I mean, I think it's even more appropriate now to shift over to the article that you guys had about what amounts to threat inflation. About, you know, why is it that so many people are saying we're so unsafe when in fact we are, by many objective standards, from my point of view. That statement doesn't really make any sense, but by many objective standards, we are safer than we've ever been. And this is basically the argument you make, that national security people say all the time, oh my goodness, the world is so dangerous, but, you know, check it out. There is no Soviet Union. The Soviet Union was a pretty big deal. It was a genuine threat, and we don't have that anymore.
Right.
So, first, I mean, I guess, do you want to sort of briefly summarize, and then I want to try to connect this notion of threat inflation and so forth to questions of why R2P becomes such a big deal, why, or whether or more generally about expansions of what we think of as national interest that we sort of talked about at the beginning. So, I mean, why don't you go ahead and summarize first, or you know, give a full summary of your argument.
I think you sort of set it up pretty well. I mean, what we sort of argue in the piece, and this is at the Foreign Affairs website now for at least another 10 days, it's out from behind the firewall, so I encourage you to read it. Yeah, not you, but everyone who's watching this. But, you know, the basic crux of it is that the conventionalism is we live in a dangerous world, and we don't. We live in a very safe world. We live in a world there are no significant existential threats to the U.S. Mm-hmm. We have no great power rival. The world is getting less violent, freer, healthier, more prosperous than ever before. And that is the reality of the world that we live in. And yet we consistently, run our foreign policy around this idea that we live in a dangerous world, there's lots of threats out there, that we have to have this gigantic military and, you know, ability to project power all over the globe in order to protect these interests and to stop these threats from harming us when they don't really exist. And so, in a sense, our piece, we sort of go through the different so-called threats, you know, nuclear terrorism and Iran and China and cyber, which is my favorite, and I'm basically pointing out that most of these really aren't threats. They're challenges, and some of them are even opportunities. And in fact, actually, the greatest threat that I would even say we do face, the only real one, is climate change, which we don't deal with at all. We deal with it, but Congress and Washington deal with it at all. And so our response to this is we need to recognize that we sort of helped create the world we wanted to create. And that we should sort of recognize that and adopt our foreign policy to this reality, as opposed to continue looking out there for threats and new things to be worried about. And of course, we argue in the piece that there's a reason, though, however, why we keep doing this, because basically, you know, there's lots of political benefit, there's lots of bureaucratic, you know, elements that drive this sort of threat inflation, and there's very little incentive for people to basically argue that in fact the world is safe. And so actually, right, one of the things that Mike and I sort of joked about, Mike Kozenko, my co-author, is that, you know, it's sort of weird for think tankers to talk about the world being safe, because if you're a think tanker, your kind of job is to sort of say, no, the world's not safe, and here are all the things we need to do to deal with it. And here, you should listen to my little rice bowl here that I'm focused on, and that's what we need to put more money and energy into. So.
I guess one place that, from my point of view, really sort of captures this is where Romney, or Governor Romney, soon to be nominee Romney, talks about how we have the smallest Navy since 1912 or something like that. And some, there are some comebacks to that, which are sort of unsatisfying. Oh, yeah, but we have airplanes and Tomahawk missiles. It's a much more effective Navy. The really effective comeback is that, we have the smallest Navy since 1912, but in 1912 we had the third largest navy in the world, right? The Germans and the British both had bigger navies. Now we have the largest navy in the world by some massive number factor in terms of quantity, quality, everything else. And that's a relevant consideration, right? I mean, with our smaller navy, we are much more secure than we were in 1913, and in fact we're much more secure than we were in 1985 when the Russians had a big navy, even though our navy was bigger, relative numbers count. What if we were to do something like then connect this, as I had suggested earlier, to, and I don't want to sound like a Ron Paul supporter here, but if we connect this notion of threat expansion and so forth, how about we also connect it to a notion that America's national interests are generally more expansive, right? That it's in America's national interest to do things like support, to more that having expansive or tremendous military capacity also makes us broaden our national security perspective, broaden our idea of what national security is, such that we extend it to meaning such things as protecting the people of Benghazi, which, you know, certainly is something that Thomas Jefferson probably never would have thought was a relevant foreign policy concern. I mean, do you see some connection there as well, or is it more of a sort of global normative story that other countries are sort of buying into R2P and so forth? What are your thoughts?
No, in fact, and in fact, you know, part of it is that we view every region of the world as one that has, you know, some kind of vital national security interest. Mm-hmm. And in fact, I have to say, I'm kind of guilty here a little bit, because I'm saying there's some national security interest in Libya, when in reality, our national security interest, you know, in the region is probably more limited than we think it is. Mm-hmm. And I think that in general, I mean, there's two things here. One is we define our interests very broadly, which means that we have to sort of be everywhere, and that we have to be sort of the policemen of everywhere. And so we have to have a giant presence in Europe, a giant presence in the Far East, because we have interest there. Mm-hmm. And part of the problem there, I think, I mean, is that I think we tend to think that only we can handle these problems, and we tend to, and it's weird because, you know, we kind of fought the Cold War in a lot of respects by burden sharing, right?
Right.
Well, except when we didn't. I mean, but generally speaking, that was the idea. We seem to ignore the notion that, like, you know, talk about the Navy, for example. You know, there's all these calls now, and I saw a recent report from AEI saying we need to build a bigger Navy. Mm-hmm. You know, why can't the Asian countries actually build a bigger Navy too? And why can't we share the burden of East Asian security? Why, for example, is 85%, I believe, of NATO's military budget, you know, supported by the U.S.? I mean, why doesn't Europe pay for their own security? And I love this a few months ago when Gates gave the speech attacking the Europeans, you know, for the umpteenth time for not paying for their security. But if you're the Europeans, you say, why should we pay for it? We know that if we don't, you're going to do it. I mean, we're like Uncle Sucker. We just basically let ourselves take advantage of because we refuse to sort of entertain this notion that these burdens should be shared by other countries. And so I think that kind of drives this sort of limitless view of interest. I mean, in a sense, you know, part of why I almost liked the NATO thing, I mean, in Libya, was that there was, you know, other regional actors who were involved in that. And I think leading from behind actually is a good model. We should lead from behind.
It was startlingly effective in operational terms in Libya. There's no question about that.
Well, leading from behind, you're saying.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I just think in general, though, what's wrong with leading from behind? Why should we always be out in the front? Why can't the actors in the region take the lead in their own security or dealing with issues that are actually, you know, vital to them? That's part of what I think, you know, and it's, of course, you know, amusing that this became a big attack line from the Republicans, and of course the White House immediately denied it and was, you know, very antsy about being seen as leading from behind, but in fact they should embrace it. I think it's the kind of model that I think most Americans would be supportive of, actually.
Right. Well, I mean, there may also be I wonder if there's also a psychological aspect here, and you frame it, we can frame it in terms of, say, the Caucasus or the Black Sea, and you could make an argument that, you know, we can see U.S. military influence in the Caucasus and the Black Sea waning over the next 10 to 15 years if Russia, you know, carries through some of its military expansion plans, if certain political things happen with Armenia and Azerbaijan and so forth. And so you can make up a scary story about, oh, no, American influence in the Caucasus is waning, and our military dominance in this critical part of the globe is undergoing a stark reduction. And that's not even wrong, right? I mean, on some level, it's actually correct to say that our dominance in this ability. You know, the same thing, you could say the same thing about the South China Sea, right, that our ability to project power into the South China Sea is waning. But the what this misses, of course, is that in comparison to 1987, when, you know, the Soviet Union actually occupied all of these areas, it's all your baseline. But the point is that where you started the baseline, it really affects how you think about how threats have increased and how capabilities have increased and decreased over time. And so anyway, no, I mean, I did think it was a fabulous article. I thought it was a fabulous and very useful article, and one that I pretty much agreed with. You know, not enough people have the courage to come out and say that everything's fine. And you too did. I mean, you were able to come out and say, no, everything's cool, we're all fine. Well, I like that Foreign Affairs also was able to come out and say, no, everything's fine, we don't have to worry about it. It's good.
Yes, and can I just say the one thing, and this is kind of what did this for me, is that I'm watching the speech from Romney back in Labor Day. He spoke to VFW, and he lists all of these threats, you know, Korea and the Pakistan and you know, his all Arvin's dangerous world. And if you unpack each of these issues, I mean, they're challenges. I mean, Pakistan's a challenge. North Korea's a challenge. But they're not real threats to the U.S. Right. You know, they're issues for us to deal with, but they don't represent the issues that we need to mobilize $600 million a year in defense spending for. Right. And what's but, of course, you know, that argument, which I think is so intuitive to most anybody who looks at international relations, is just – it's not part of the debate. And what really brought this home for me – I mean, Ron is a politician, so I get it, right? But this happened about back in February. Martin Dempsey, who is the chairman of Joint Chiefs of Staff, and I wrote about this at the time, but he got up to – in Congress, and he said that that moment, right then and there, February 15th, 2012, was the most dangerous moment in his lifetime. Now, he was born in 52, right, during the Korean War. He lived through the Cold War. He lived through the Cuban Missile Crisis. He lived through Vietnam. He lived through, you know, the Reagan buildup. He lived through all of these incredibly dangerous moments. And yet, 2012 is the most dangerous. I mean, it's ludicrous. I mean, I can't. He should be fired for saying that. It's so incredibly strategically, obviously strategically wrong. But it's taken for granted. I mean, you really don't hear a lot of questioning of it. And I will say one thing. You know, I've never seen Obama say this, actually. He sort of hints around it, but he doesn't say it in his world. I actually think he recognizes it's not, although he's still sort of, you know, obviously, like any president, has to sort of play up threats like things in Libya and Afghanistan and so on. But it's such an obvious thing, and that it doesn't sort of, you know, penetrate the national discourse about our global standing. I think really it speaks to how much you have this whole sort of national security bureaucracy, and I mean both inside and outside of government, wedded to, you know, to pushing this idea that we are in danger. And so it's hard to see how you sort of get away from that. I mean, to my mind, the way you get away from it in a sense is you actually have a smaller military, because that's the first thing, because then it tends to, even if you think the world is full of threats, maybe you don't overreact to those threats. But you know, that's maybe like the way to get around this problem. But you know, until people sort of believe this, you're going to keep having these kind of overreactions to global events like 9/11, and you know, this sort of thing will continue.
Right. I mean, the hope would be that there could be over time some sort of slow but steady drawdown in terms of the bureaucratic necessity for threat inflation. But you know, it's also hard to see. I mean, given how many agencies require a strong threat in order to justify themselves. I mean, this is just to say that the national security state does a fabulous job of justifying itself. I mean, it does a consistently fabulous job of justifying itself. So
yes, it does. Yeah.
You recently. Here's another question, and it has to go. It also has to do with this expansive understanding of interest, and also with the way that we frame. How we frame human rights. People have sort of, I think, begun to realize that human rights conversation is a double-edged sword from an anti-militarist perspective. That talking about human rights is all fine and well, but human rights have also, or the language of human rights has also, especially over the last 15 years or so, come to justify any number of different military interventions, or at least play a justificatory role or part of the justificatory apparatus. You wrote a piece for The Guardian talking about reproductive health and how, I mean, I don't want to, but essentially talk about how reproductive health really is, should be understood, and reproductive freedom really should be understood as one of these fundamental human rights. And I think you were absolutely right, and I'm completely supportive of that position. But is there a point at which people who talk about human rights and human freedoms need to start being careful about how they delineate those freedoms? Because they are going to provide sort of the linguistic foundation for an expansive understanding of our security and an expansive understanding of threats. Now, and I don't mean this to say, you know, the United States is never going to invade a country to ensure access to abortion, right? I mean, there's just so much wrong with that.
That's not going to happen.
Right. But you will hear from a lot of people that women's rights are a key reason for why the United States should remain in Afghanistan. And I'm not judging that argument one way or the other. I'm just saying that you find that argument. You find that argument on the right, but you also find it in precincts on the left.
You hear a lot on the left, yes.
Right, you hear a lot on the left. Well, I mean, listen, Michael Goldfarb told me that if you talk to Republican women, this is what they say about why we should be in Afghanistan. So you have that language appropriated. I mean, at what point do people who believe in human rights and who talk about human rights and sort of more broadly human rights regime have to start being really careful about how far they push the question of human rights before it starts inspiring military action, before it starts moving tanks?
Yeah, that's a great point, and I don't know the answer to that, and I have to think about it for a little bit. But it's interesting because you're absolutely right that this happened a lot during the '90s too, in the Balkans Wars. You had a lot of folks on the left, and I think what's interesting about what happened there is a lot of folks on the left pushed this idea of military intervention to deal with humanitarian crisis, and in a sense, it gave them a lot less credibility to go after Bush on the Iraq War in some respects. And in fact, mm-hmm. you know, if you look back at it now, a lot of these liberal interventionists really were very supportive of the Iraq War. I mean, not very supportive, they were supportive of the Iraq War. And yeah. often for reasons different from that expounded by the Bush administration, but they saw, you know, a humanitarian benefit in going to war. And I mean, I think the classic example of this is, you know, Michael Ignatieff wrote, mm-hmm. you know, was right. wrote actually relatively a good piece about this, where he pointed out that he, in fact, was wrong. And part of the reason he was wrong is because he wanted to see, you know, Saddam, you know, gotten rid of. Sure. And I think that there is a real danger here in liberals especially becoming sort of, and I don't mean, this will sound very caustic, but, you know, with a grain of salt, sort of useful idiots in a sense for this kind of military intervention. Mm-hmm. And I think it's a great point that, you know, this sort of human rights debate can get much too expansive to the point where it leads to the kind of excesses we've seen over the past 10 years.
All right, I have to apologize because I have to cut it off right now. I have childcare responsibilities today. But yes. This has been, I think this has been a fantastic conversation, and we should do it again pretty soon.
Yeah, always a pleasure. Always a pleasure to talk. So let's do it again soon.
All right, well, Foreign Entanglements viewers, thank you for watching, and please come back next week when we'll have at least one more devlog and possibly two more. I hope that you are all having a wonderful day as well, and a wonderful Passover.
Happy Passover and a good Friday.
I mean, we could have debated gefilte fish, because you said you like gefilte fish, and that just makes
sense. I love gefilte fish. It's
an incomparably awful food. It's just the worst
No, it's the food of affliction. It's delicious.
I mean, really. I say this coming from a non-Jewish perspective, having been forced to eat gefilte fish, and it's really
maybe it's
awful.
A genetic thing. I don't know, yeah. But I do love my wife not so much, but I love it's sort of a vehicle for horseradish. It's really quite good. I think.
Well, that's true, and I am strongly pro horseradish. No matter how much being pro horseradish is going to inspire us to invade some country that grows horseradish. Anyway, we'll talk to you soon.
Talk to you later. Bye-bye.